Hi, this is Frank Schaefer. I have had the pleasure of talking to some of the leading authors, artists, activists, and change makers of our time on this podcast. And I want to personally thank you for subscribing, listening, and sharing 100 plus episodes over 100,000 times. We have a lot of work to do to heal our divisions and secure our democracy. And I look forward to more conversations with those important voices that will bring clarity to the situation we find ourselves in as we move toward November of 2024. If you appreciate these conversations and my cultural and political commentary, please subscribe to this podcast, In Conversation with Frank Schaefer, on your favorite platform, and to my Substack, It Has to Be Said, which can be found at frankschaefer.substack.com. I'd really appreciate the help. Thank you.
We've come a long way in a lot of different things, but I do believe the problem is that technology has and continues to exceed our social capability of absorbing it.
Hi, this is Frank Schaefer, and this is my podcast, In Conversation with Frank Schaefer. It goes out live on Facebook and then goes to YouTube, is available on Facebook later, becomes a podcast where people can find podcasts on Substack and all those other places. And I've got an incredibly interesting person to interview today and a book of his that has come out. And I want to talk about that. And before I get into it, first of all, let me just say we're talking to Ed Hajim, and his book is The Island of Four Peas, A Modern Fable About Preparing for Your Future. There's the book. And I'm going to take the liberty of reading a little bit from the about the author section at the back. I was going to put it up in the chat section here, but I'm just going to read here. Ed Hajim is the son of a Syrian immigrant, a seasoned Wall Street executive with more than 50 years investment experience. He has held senior management positions with the Capital Group, E. F. Hutton and Lehman Brothers, before becoming chairman and CEO of Furman Seltz, et cetera, et cetera. And now he has written a book that is kind of a parable for our modern times, is the way I'd put it. There's a series of stories in it. After each story, it's a work of fiction, a kind of a Gulliver's Travel. I don't know exactly what to liken it to, but a series of stories with a point. There's always a section afterwards with a Q&A in terms of what can be discussed from the point that is being made here. For instance, from a chapter called The Village of Passions, Key Ideas and Questions, passions are the powerful interests that drive us forward in life. They should be the starting point for the plans we create. Our passions and our strengths are often closely linked, and that can be powerful, but where they diverge, we should concentrate on our passions. There can be practical barriers to pursuing our passions, including time, cost, and knowledge, and so forth. The part of your biography that interested me most, Ed, at the back of the book, just starting with something personal, was the amount of time that you and your wife have been married, the fact that you have 8 grandchildren. It ties in with my life in that my wife, Jeannie, and I met when we were 17 and 18, and that was 53 years ago. We're together still. We have 3 grown children and 5 grandchildren. When I'm done this meeting with you here, I'll be running over to a day camp my youngest granddaughter is in. She's 9 now, and she has a presentation. And I wanted to make sure before I did this today that I scheduled that, which is kind of where my priorities are. And that's a long way of saying that in reading The Island of Four Peas and your own philosophy of life, which is really what the book is about, kind of a how-to in a way, it seems to me that you and I share something in that, in spite of the fact you've been incredibly career-oriented and terrifically successful in what you've done, you also have a series of values which I think has sustained your family life. And I'd kind of like to start with that and dig in a little bit from that personal life angle to what you've written here in this remarkable book, The Island of Four Peas. Is that a reasonable place to begin?
Exactly. It's exactly the place to begin. It comes back to my basic theory. There are 4-8 words I use that are very important. You've covered almost all of them. I believe why life is developed into 4 what I call buckets: self, You spend a lot of time on self between 0 and 25 years. You spend time on yourself later on, but those are the key area, key earliness, finding out who you are, what you want to do, who, what your passions are. So the second is family, which you've talked about. The third is work. And the fourth, in my mind, is community, which is my word for giving back. Mm-hmm. And it's a balancing act. And just like you're balancing today, you're talking to me now, but you're moving over into your family. What I tell people is that balance isn't something that no one achieves. You're always out of balance because by definition, in order to be successful with self, family, work, or community, you have to focus on one of them. As soon as you focus on that one, the others get neglected to some extent. So you get, the game plan is to find out how out of focus you are. And of course, out of focus examples are all over us. The successful businessman who loses his family. The successful businessman who never does anything in giving back and misses out on great satisfaction. But into those four buckets of life, I want you to pour the four pitchers or the four P's: passions, principles, partners, and plans. And what I want you to do is develop a conversation with yourself, because we're all unique. And this is not a book on what's right or wrong. This is a book on how to talk to yourself, how to talk to your children, how to talk to your grandchildren. You know, Christopher Morley said something like, a book is a trap to basically have you do your own thinking. And that's basically what this book is trying to say. And we have not only a young man, we have a young lady in there. And by the way, the older man who takes the young man through the island of the four P's is not a teacher. He's a guide. He's guiding the young man to make his own decisions, guiding the young lady to make their own decisions, and so on. And that's basically what I'm trying to do. You know, I want young people to find a better methodology to make life decisions.
Yeah, it seemed to me, too, that in reading a little bit about you, that I'd like to bookend the discussion of this book with the family, which we talked about, and a kind of a basic presentation that you just made of what the book is about. But then in your own life, you know, you've had some remarkable kind of events and of philanthropy. You've given some remarkable amounts of money to some people and done other things like that. I'd like to take a sort of a deep step back to your own philosophy that undergirds this work in terms of philanthropy, family life. You know, I had a very religious background. I sort of walked away from it in the sense that I came out of an evangelical religious right background, grew up in the 1970s, became a kind of a figure in that world, and then left it for a different point of view. I'm always interested in digging down, because I've done writing in my own life about this, to someone's background. Who are your parents? What did they do? What did you grow up with any kind of religion or not? What has your own journey been in that area that you would say kind of has undergirded the rest of your life to develop these ideas in the island of four P's? So what came before this in terms of your own personal history? You know, I guess the shorthand thing is, who are you?
Well, that's, you know, and who am I? I mean, I can describe myself as a person who graduated from grammar school, high school, college, and graduate school, and nobody ever came to my graduation.
Right.
That can describe my whole life. But it is, my early lives were very bumpy. Mother and father got divorced at age 3. Mother got custody, took me to St. Louis from Los Angeles. Father kidnapped me, brought me back to Los Angeles, told mother not to look for me. She didn't. And he told me my mother died. And that's, the book is interesting. You can read about that. But basically, I was brought up, and we were Jewish, but my father decided the Catholic welfare system was better. So I spent the first between ages 5 and 10 in Catholic schools. And that really, in many respects, as you talk about evangelical Christian, I mean, I learned what was right and wrong. And I learned the golden rule with the golden ruler. It was very simple. And Mun made it very clear: if you did the right thing, you went to the right place. If you did the other stuff, you went to the wrong place. And so as a youngster, that was built in early. And it carried through my entire life, actually. In fact, as you know, my 10 years old, I wrote my father asking for my baptismal papers, which obviously maybe there were someplace, but the church sect didn't have them. But then, I studied other religions as I got older, and I basically found out there are some really basic principles that I would follow the rest of my life. And I kept writing them down. And it started with the golden rule and the 10 commandments. And then you keep adding to that and you become more specific. In other words, my passion, I turned out from when I started with math and science and baseball and basketball, girls, that evolved. It evolved at some point in my life to basically, I enjoyed mostly putting people together to solve a problem or create a product or find an answer. But I like management. But the principle I had to have was, if you don't worry about who gets the credit, you can create almost anything. You can be successful, whatever you do. Then I took that a next step further, was basically a principle of deflecting credit. So that's, I'm giving you a little slice of what made me who I am. But I learned it by doing. And I believe when people ask me, what should you do with young people? Have them test, have them reach, have them try things out. And I did that. If you look back in my life, I wanted to be a physics. I wanted to be a physicist. So my sophomore year, I took physics and I flunked it and realized that I couldn't do it. I just didn't want to spend the effort and the time to compete in that arena. And I learned something. So that goes on. So who am I? I'm basically a conglomerate. And that's why I recommend people keep trying things out. Luckily, and it sounds lucky given the fact that I was in orphanages and foster homes, but I got two or three different religions. I experienced a whole group of different people. Foster homes varied from being cold and abusive to warm and caring. So I understood what warm and caring was, and I understood what cold and abusive was. So many respects, disadvantages of my early life made me who I am, and actually turned out many of them to be advantages. I had some disadvantages. I mean, when you grow up like I do, and I communicate with young people, that you're angry. Because you, as a youngster, you're always looking around when you're poor and being thrown around in different places. You say, why me? And that builds up. And what you have to do when you get to be a certain age and get out on your own is convert that anger internally to make yourself better. If you take it externally, you're dead. You're just, if you start, becoming a victim, and one of my principles is never be a victim. And if you look at my life, even when I was at fault, I failed early. Early failure is a gift. I was never a victim. I went on. Later on, when I was very successful at Lehman Brothers, and they still threw me out, not my fault. I could have fought them. I didn't fight them. I went on to what's next. I wasn't a victim. So that's making me who I am. And then giving back is easy, because my major principle today, they asked, what's your principle, Ed? It's gratitude. I really believe I've been privileged to get the things that I've gotten. And I focused a significant part of my charity on that point in life that I think is very important, is the youngster who gets to be 17 years old can take that next step, but doesn't have the financial capability to do it. So I have 300 or 400 scholarships in 8 or 10 different institutions, and I continue to put more money in that arena. And I'm trying to find out, I have found institutions like the Wiley Group in Boston that basically takes these foster kids and gives them somebody to talk to, because that's one of the secrets in life, is having someone interested in you. And, you may say my father abandoned me 3 times, almost 4 times, but he always loved me. And his letters and his conversation was, you're the greatest. And, that was enough to take me to the next step. And so I find those things. That's what I try to do with mentoring my students that I know and so forth. Keep telling them that you can do it. You're the man, you're the person, you're the gal, and so forth. So that's who I am. I've been very lucky. And that early training taught me to continue to seek different arenas. Mm-hmm. And it also let me understand different people. I mean, when I interviewed many people, I could immediately relate to almost everybody. Harvard Business School and St. James School in Los Angeles is a big spread.
Yeah.
Is that too much? My daughter says, I always answer.
Not at all. I wanted to dive into something, because I think having read the book, but also just looking at your biography and the age you are, father, grandfather, at a certain stage of life, I would love to get some wisdom from you on something that bothers me, but it may be my ignorance, because I'm an artist, I'm a writer. I have not come through the same passage you have. We share some things in terms of values, but it seems to me that there has arisen a generation of entrepreneur in this country that are very much libertarian in their view of a kind of an almost sort of macho masculinity of I'll do it my way. They don't seem to have much sense of responsibility to the community. There's very little of what you've got in your book or what we've just been talking about here in terms of giving back, and very little sort of social consciousness. You look at some of the philanthropy of the past, or people who made a lot of money did all sorts of things. They may have screwed up their personal lives, but in the 19th and early 20th century, there was always a period in the rise of some of these titans where they kind of doubled back and they left either institutions or work or giving or some form of saying, look, I have some responsibility for this society. Two points. It seems to me a lot of the high tech entrepreneurs have not thought through what they have done to young people in terms of what's going on. And they don't seem to care. And they seem unreachable on these issues. Secondly, I don't see a generation coming out of that group of philanthropy. I see more a kind of hubris, in terms of just, hey, I to hell with everybody, we're going to do it my way, and so on. I don't know, I don't want to put any words in your mouth, but you're someone who's actually achieved the kind of things they all talk about in terms of ambition, but you've come up with a different set of ideas in how you see yourself. And I wonder where that kind of lack of hubris comes from in you, which is wonderful, but also what has happened with this latest batch of entrepreneurs that just seem to leave wreckage in their path in so many ways. And I, maybe you don't see it that way, but I'd really be interested, even if you don't agree with what I'm saying, to hear your opinion on it.
I struggle with this just like you. You're struggling with it. My contention is it has to do with context. See, we grew up, I was born in the Depression, had a war. You know, the 50s and 60s were pretty good, but the 70s were awful again. I had difficult times, and I realized there were difficult times. And having difficult times myself, I appreciated that it's time, I want to help people like me. The last 40 years, or even 50 years, since the 80s, has been almost, one question, too good. And so they don't understand that there can be tough times. And they don't think there's any reason that can. So what you're basically, you're focused on this one structure, which that's why divorce is so prevalent today. They're focused on the one bucket, which is work. And what I want to communicate to them is, look, I went to work for E.F. Hutton, my famous firm that I went to work for. It no longer exists. I went to work for Lehman Brothers, even more famous firm. Doesn't exist today. Herman Sells, I helped build from scratch from $20 million to $500 million. It's gone now today. Now, the giving back part, the kids that I give scholarships to, going to be here at least for another generation. The school that I've been involved with, and, they've been very kind to me. I have a quadrangle named after me and George Eastman, which, as far as I'm concerned, is way off charts. But, so that's be there for the golf club. Let me just give you an example. I went to Nantucket and I got rejected at all the clubs, even though I was 60 years old and a trustee of this and trustee of that. They just happened to reject me. And my wife, God bless her, said, why don't you build a golf course? You built one in Vail. So we built a golf course. I'm member number one, which is a pretty good deal. And everybody said, oh, the rich people are building golf courses again. Now, today, we're the largest charity on the island. Last year, we gave our 34th and 35th academic scholarship. We started a vocational scholarship program. We gave 10 vocational scholarships last year. Just, you're the symbol. You walk down Main Street, they look at your symbol on your shirt, the people come and thank you. So, and I hope that I can take these entrepreneurs, technical entrepreneurs, and say, really, there's another whole bucket out there which will give you essentially greater satisfaction. And you're doing something. What are we put on the planet for? We put on the planet to give back in two ways with our family, which is, I might say it's harder than charity, but those are the two things you give back at. So I think that's one of the communications I want to get across, is that this fourth bucket is so important. I also focus. When I took the chairman's job at the University of Rochester, which is 30,000 people and $4 billion, I closed my hedge fund because I felt I had to focus. And so I found another job which didn't require me, day to day and so forth. So, I'm not sure. Not all some of these tech people are pretty enthusiastic about helping out, but they are really focused on what they're doing. Plus the fact many of them have been dealing with enormous change very rapidly. And it makes them, much more conscious of what they're doing every day. And they see the successes and failures. And they don't have a lot of role models. In other words, people say, who are your heroes? I said, don't look at heroes. Try to take part of the hero. Like, I'd love to have Winston Churchill's perseverance, but not his drinking habits. In the case of Steve Jobs, his creativity is off the charts, but I don't want his personality. But he is a role model for these guys. And his personality was terrible. Mm-hmm. And, that's the kind of thing. You haven't seen someone in our arena yet. There are a few tech people that cover all the bases, but not many. You're right. And I can't pick them out. I don't know them as well as I did because I was engineer in a different arena when it was, much lower tech. But I am only empathetic with them is that they're dealing with enormous change. But I must admit, the biggest problem is that they've grown up in a very, very easy, positive, you know, people don't realize stock market, which is just a gauge of the world, and 1983 was 600. Today it's 30,000. If that's a gauge, you know, that's a pretty easy time. That's what people say, you get a great job, Ed. No, the wind was at my back. And in my fourth chapter there, I say, most successful people, even non-financial, doctors and so forth, they get the wind at their back for some part of their life. And that makes life a little easier. So if you can merge your passion and your principles with some kind of a wave during your lifetime, you'll let you become, you know, pretty successful pretty easily. And I was just very lucky in many respects because I found a wave and I was pretty good at it and I loved it and so on. So that's a long answer to a very complicated question. And it's not, I don't think it's all one thing. I think there are plenty of tech people that are contributing to society. But as a group, you're right. They're not paying as much attention as they should to the effect they're having.
One of the kind of tells for me anyway is the kind of libertarian Ayn Randian idealism on one hand, saying, you know, we're doing it ourselves. We don't want any government intrusion. God forbid there's any regulation of what we're doing. Hands off, you know, we're the new thing. But then on the other hand, when you actually dig a little bit into anybody's life, just what you're saying, you know, being in the right time at the right place is a big part of it. It isn't just our greatness and skill or genius at something. And then the other thing is the way our culture is structured. It seems to me that, you know, the internet itself is an invention of, you know, was financed by government. You know, we're all driving on the same roads. We all call 911 if we have a problem. I find it odd, this kind of opposition to community writ large and an emphasis always on individualism. It comes out in a lot of anti-government stuff, but also just in a sense of a lack of responsibility for the world around us, as if somehow, well, there's going to be collateral damage, you know, but we're pressing forward. A lot of emphasis on what we can do, not much discussion of what we should do. Hi, this is Frank Schaefer. If you appreciate my cultural and political commentary, please do me a favor and subscribe to my Substack, It Has to Be Said, which can be found at frankschaefer.substack.com. You can subscribe for free, or you can kick in a couple of dollars a month and help me out and help me keep this going if you're able. Either way, I'm incredibly grateful for your support and most of all for your participation. We have a lot of work to do to heal our divisions and secure our democracy as we move toward November of 2024. And every subscription helps create, build, sustain, and put voice to this movement for truth. Thank you so much.
You're right. Historically, though, in some respects, we've come a long way. As you remember, in the old days, they dumped everything in the river.
Yeah.
Now you don't do that anymore. So, you know, there have been some in Los Angeles in the 80s when I was there, you know, you couldn't breathe. Okay. We solved that problem. So, you know, that's one of the things I you know, people, you know, you want to be perfect, but in many respects, we've come a long way in a lot of different things. But I do believe the problem is that technology has and continues to exceed our social capability of absorbing it. But we continue to try. Government, I try not to comment on government. I would just like it easier for really competent people to be involved in government. And it's just very hard. Because you go down to Washington and you look at a job down there and the kind of hurdles you have to jump over, you say, why should I do that?
What's been your experience in that? I'm going to get into the book deeper in a minute, but you know, your life experience is so interesting. I just want to take advantage of having you here. Obviously, you have interfaced with government agencies and government in Washington, D.C. because of the success you've had in business and also in education and all the rest. What has been your worst experience and your best experiences in that area? I'm not asking necessarily for one story, but just curious. You must have been tremendously frustrated at some points and at other times found somebody that listened or whatever. I'm just curious about how that worked for you.
Oh, I guess in business, it was, you know, the institutional invasion of the financial business where you got someone to come into your shop. And one particular experience that they were in my shop for 9 months and they had to find something. So they found something that was, you know, minimal. I must say, in my chapter on partners, one of the things I got is I got a partner who could deal with that. I am not good at that. And I knew that. I don't have the patience and so forth. And he was a 6'5" Dartmouth graduate. He just knew how to handle it. We had an agency in our shop, and it's a little shop, you know, and like JP Morgan has 400 of these guys hanging around. But we had one or two every couple of weeks in our shop. And you know, one group stayed for 9 months to try to find something. They found something. The fine was, I don't know, $50,000 or something. It was ridiculous because the amount of energy and time we spent on it. That's the worst thing. The best thing I found is when going to Washington with projects from the University of Rochester, we got fairly good reception. And of course, with the NIH, we have about $400 million a year of research grants. And for things that were way out. I mean, you know, we've been studying neurological diseases now for a decade. You know, we're moving towards solving Alzheimer's, which must be solved, by the way. You know, you look at the numbers there, by 2050, we'll have 35 million people with dementia. I mean, you can't handle that. Each one has a caregiver. You're really in trouble as far as society is going. But Rochester started early. We've got money for that. And I think that's one of the big experiences. There is some government efforts to do the right thing. You know, there are people down there. If you find the right person, you have the right pitch. But it's hard. It's a hard pull. That's the outside of it. As far as business is concerned, I've never found, you know, government terribly helpful in anything that I was doing. Because the financial business, and we were, you know, we've made mistakes in the financial business, but in many respects, it's a combination of the finance and the government. I mean, you know, the whole mortgage thing, which they blame on Wall Street, was basically because the government wanted to give everybody a house. And, you know, so Wall Street took advantage of the mortgage market. So I think there's always a bad partnership there. But those are the two extremes that I saw. Government is, you know, but I believe in the balance between government and business. I think it's very necessary. And, you know, again, if you look back in history, the older titans were actually worse than these. I mean, I'm a chemical engineer and I did a lot of early studies. I mean, you built plants on rivers so you could put stuff into it and save money, you know, and that's it. You put things into the air and so forth. So there's a little more consciousness now than has ever been, I think.
Hey, let me reintroduce you. And now let's talk more about the book. I'm going to go page at a time here.
Well, I love this, but sorry.
I'm enjoying it. We're gonna get back to the other discussion too, but we're talking about this book here. Ed Haigham is someone who's written a book, which is kind of a parable for our own times. It's a story called The Island of the Four Ps. And basically the subtitle is A Modern Fable About Preparing for Your Future. This is Frank Schaefer. This is In Conversation with Frank Schaefer. It is a podcast and all sorts of other things. And if you like it, quote, in the sense of liking it, please like it online as well and tell folks about it and share this with them. I want to just turn some pages here and talk about the structure of the book. First of all, as I understand it, the structure of a book is a series of stories. It's a fiction. Then the stories... at the end of each individual story, the fable, behind the fable, the two parts of the book, a quest begins, the village of passions, the village of principles, the village of partners, the village of plans one, the village of plans two. Each of these stories makes a point, which is then summed up, as I said earlier in this discussion, at the end of each chapter with not exactly a to-do list, but what might almost be a discussion guide if this book was being used with a group. So why don't you just take us through those points that you were making? It's hard to tell the story here without reading it out loud, and people who read the book will get the stories. Let's just cut to the chase on the points you were making with the stories, the points of the parables. Equivalent would be, you know, Jesus tells a parable about, you know, the sower in the field, the seed falling on barren ground. The point he's making is the way each individual human heart approaches spirituality is the difference. It's going to be the same gospel each time. It's how we approach it. You're doing the same thing. You're basically throwing your story out there. And then at the end of the story, you're doing what Jesus did in his parables. You're saying, yeah, and here, you know, here is the conclusion I would like you to draw. You're not leaving that up to chance. So let's go through the conclusions that you are hoping people draw by reading the book, what you hope they're talking about in the discussion group if they read it as a group, say in a book club or in a school or a high school. Let's talk about how you would lead them through the discussion on the sections. Just let's start with the first story. What do we want people to be talking about after they read that?
Let me step back one little bit. The four P's I want to be, eventually you get two more P's. One is your path and your purpose. That's why we're going through the four P's to try to understand it. And this is basically trying to give you a vocabulary that you could talk to yourself, your children, your grandchildren, your coworkers. We want a vocabulary which is simple enough so that when you go back to it, you can look at it and say, that's what I thought. I've changed a bit. I'm going to change that a bit. So let's start off. I believe very important that one should understand their passions. What really excites them? What makes them get up in the morning? What really, and by the way, passion is an overused word. It includes your talents. It includes things you like and dislike. It also is contextual. You know, you have to figure out what part of the history you're living in, and that's what your passions are basically based on. And you should try to find those out as soon as possible. And in the end of the chapter, write them down so that three years from now, as I did from high school to college, I noticed how they changed and understood how that change affected me. And that basically focusing on those things could come to the conclusion what my true passions were, which were very different from my passions in high school. And, you know, because people change as they change where they are. So that's the first thing.
Let's just stop a second. What was the difference? What were the passions in high school?
Passions were math and science. I was very good in both. Baseball and basketball, I'm a varsity athlete. And girls. I mean, women were a very important thing in my life and, you know, still are. Married for 57 years. And then when I went to college, the math and science morphed first. I thought I'd be a physicist. That didn't work out. And I ended up being an engineer, chemical engineer. My athletic endeavor stopped the freshman year. I realized I wouldn't be a professional athlete. The time required was soaking up too much of my effort. I changed that into extracurricular activities and became involved in almost everything. Now, being an orphanage and basically drawing a line, I wouldn't tell anybody where I came from. We lived in a post office box in San Francisco. My mother died when I was three. End of story. Never mentioned I was in an orphanage or a foster home. I kept myself very busy, which maybe extracurricular activities did that for me. I was the editor of the yearbook. I was the business manager of Dramatic Society. I was in charge of all the finances, chairman of the finance board. I was even social chairman of my fraternity. And, you know, but in my junior year, I got this harebrained idea to start a humor magazine like, you know, the magazine at Harvard. And so I put 30 people together against the president, against the provost, against the librarian, and we created a humor magazine. And I found out what I really liked to do was put people together to solve a problem or create a product. And in that, I found a lot of things about myself. So having tested this, I found a lot of different passions. I love working with people, having them do better than they thought they could. It really excited me to see people do well. And then I tried engineering. I was in Navy for a while. I was an engineer in Navy. I went out into engineering in civilian life. And I found I realized that really wasn't my passion. So I went back to business school, even though I didn't have the money and had the grades. I luckily got in. And there I morphed again. My passions started to really show themselves. Even at business school, I loved putting these people together. And I found out also one of my secrets was I didn't try to take the credit. I wrote that down. And then later on in life, I found out that what was a great excitement was to try to deflect credit whenever you get it. And then other things like that. Now my passion, as you can see, has changed completely. When I was on Wall Street, one of my principles were to live happy was to live hidden. Never talk to Frank Schaefer. Never go on television. Yeah. Never be in a newspaper. Focus on running the company. But you know, I didn't want to take the other aspect of my life and become a public figure. Now, today, I'm just the reverse now. I'm basically on TV and radio once or twice a week. I just finished Sirius XM before getting on with you. And my job is to sell my ideas. This is my new passion. And I've had to change my MO. I mean, scared me to death doing things like I'm doing today, because I always felt being a private person. I mean, my mother died. I found my mother after 57 years and didn't tell anybody for 10 years. And, you know, when she finally passed away, I happened to, you know, my wife made me write the book. So I actually put her in the book. But I became a very private person. Now I'm getting to be a public person. I'm still a little afraid of it. So that's how your passions change. And then principles start early. And by the way, in the book, we have a wonderful discussion of what should come first, principles or passions. And there's a blacksmith, and by the way, climbing up to the village of principles tells you the story. You've got to work very hard to get up to your principles. But my principles, as I said, started in the Catholic Church, I mean, with the golden rule. But all my life, I've collected principles. Some I put on my board so I could make sure I looked at them every day. Some principles disappeared, like this business about living happy is live hidden. I got away with that. But writing them down and putting them, and you can get little simple sentences, which would take you in a long direction. And I think that's very important for principles. And then partners, I think partners are very important. Partners, in my mind, I said the three kinds of partners. Partners that do things you can't do. Partners that do things better than you can do them. And partners who, this is the one I like the best of all, partners do things that you do really well, but you don't want to do. If you get those three kind of partners, either in one person or a group of people, you end up doing things you do well that you want to do. So that's fine. Also, partners, the most important partner is part P1, as I get in the book, is finding someone to love. Find someone who's truly interested in you and you can be interested in them, who you can support, who you can share your life with, because it really is very important. And then, of course, partners in business and partners in philanthropy are totally different. There are different requirements, different talents, and so forth. You have to recognize that. And then, of course, in my partner chapter, I go into the second most important partners, a friend. I tell young people, look to the left, look to the right. Find somebody that you might want to spend the rest of your life with, and make sure you communicate with them at least once or twice a year. And I had that particular person, and he's the one who convinced me as an engineer to come to Harvard Business School. He would relentless. He said, you've got to come. And when he was dying about 5-6 years ago, I would call him up, you know, like Tuesday at Maury's, and first question out of his mouth is, he's dying. He said, how are you, Ed? How are the children? How's Barbara? Are you working too hard? You're my real friend. Then finally, the Village of Plans puts it all together. What you really want to do is to take your passions and your principles and find a plan that satisfies them. And I take you through the requirements of a plan. One is to study history, make sure your context is there, then take that context and find the part that you want to be involved in, and then write it down. I was making a talk to a university now 2 or 3 years ago, and a tall, gangly kid said to me, Mr. Hageum, you give us too many ideas. I mean, one thing I can use right now. And I said, write down where you want to go, how you think you might get there, and what's going to happen during your lifetime. Not tomorrow morning, the next 30 or 40 years. And what part of that do you want to play in? And that's the plans. Now, all these things are much more complicated and require much more of a conversation. The amount of time we have this morning, you can't do that. But that's sort of what the book is all about. And it is a book basically saying, you're unique. You must make decisions. We're going to give you some questions which will help you make better life decisions. And also, better able to communicate, not only with yourself, but maybe with a mentor, maybe with a child, maybe with a grandchild. You know, I find the using a certain set of vocabulary, these 8 words, really help. And I think that's what I'm trying to communicate. And I want to do it simply. And the parable, by the way, you mentioned Gulliver's Travels. Historically, parables have been better communicators of ideas than maybe, you know, sort of, you know, this is what you're supposed to do. Look, sure. You know, Dr. Seuss.
Yeah.
Who my cheese? Don Quixote.
Even not necessarily parables. Any story seems to make the point better than something that's more direct. Yeah.
I mean, exactly. This is the way to do it.
Tell the story.
They're more memorable. You know, you'll be memorable. You'll hear a conversation in your head between two fictional characters, and that'll basically make a better decision.
In looking at the book, but also just talking to you now, it would seem to me that something that you would be running across earlier in this discussion, we talked about the difference between you, and I didn't want to put you on the spot, but and some of the more recent entrepreneurs, particularly in the tech industry, that seem all about a kind of a self-aggrandizement. I mean, the exact opposite of your approach. And, you know, you're not saying this, but I am. But, you know, when I look at some of the people like Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk and these other guys, their modus of operandi seems to be, basically industry as a rock star stage first, and then we'll see what we can do with it. I'm not going to ask you for a comment because I don't want to put you on the spot naming names, but that's my
thank you.
And I know you have bigger fish to fry, but But I think there's another side to this as well, and I would like you to comment on this. It seems to me that you know what you're saying in this book and what your life says about you and your long marriage and so forth and so on, there's a tension there that when you think things like Harvard Business School and other places, it seems to me, and again, I'm not in your business, but this is how it approached. I think one of the illnesses that our period of history suffers from is that we have a kind of a careerism that gets in the way of life. And I'm not talking about canoe trips on the weekend. I mean the real deal where I'll run into a young person because I do some speaking too. And they'll tell me, you know, I've been with my girlfriend for 6 years and now she's moving to Cincinnati, but my job's in New York and we don't know how we're going to work this out. I'm going to stay there. It's probably the end of the relationship, but hey, you got to do what you got to do. Now, in my book, having been married a long time, you know, in my hierarchy of values, I'm a writer. Okay, I'm writing a new book. But if getting that new book done or staying married to Jeannie, who has been my best friend and partner and lover and spouse and mother of my children, grandmother to my grandchildren, best, you know, the person who's through whose eyes I see the world, it would be unthinkable to me at this stage of life to get that mixed up and think that somehow some new book I'm writing is going to be, you know, that could be balanced against the relationship. So you get what I'm saying. So how do you, when you're talking to younger people or even contemporaries who might come to you for advice because you've been so successful, warn them off from this idea that what we do career-wise defines us? Because you know that's not the case. You know, how successful we are in our careers is not who we are. Who we are is who we are to the people closest to us who see us every day. And as I look back, I mean, I had my 70th birthday last summer. I look back at various things. I've had a couple bestsellers and I've, you know, been on the New York Times list. I've done a few things that writers crave. And I'm not just saying this because it sounds so good to say, but honestly, from my gut, none of those pleasures lasted but a moment. And however, the pleasure that I get in the company of the people that I love and that we built a life together, or places I love, art, beauty, the friend you had who called you up and asked. My friend was Holly Mead, a wonderful children's book illustrator who died. All the conversations I had with her when she had cancer, those are in my mind as fresh as the day they happened. I can't remember one word of a review written about a book of mine, good or bad. You understand where I'm going with that. How do you lay that out to people so they get it and really listen to the fact that life is not all about what we're telling people that it's about? We're not defined by career. So, you know, you're very successful, but how do you pass on that as a human being, the story you're telling is about a friend of yours and what he did when he was calling you while he was dying? And that's what sticks with you, the human stuff. I went on too long. Forgive me.
No. I'm going to say that what you just said is what I try to say. I do though, because I mean, it's important to make it simple. I divide these up into four buckets and I tell people, look at your friends, you know, your friends' fathers and so forth, who concentrated on their work. Mm. And what did they get out of it? You know, he has three wives and, you know, I mean, some of my most successful people on Wall Street, you end up, I read their life history. And one of my favorite people is a fabulous guy. And he worked for a firm, which I won't mention, but he's probably the most successful guy I've ever come across, both in philanthropy and in work, but he let his family go and he had three wives and the kids rejected him and so on and so forth. So it's my contention to try to put these things in front of people. And when I ask them to think about themselves, try to, you know, and basically put yourself in my shoes, look at what I did and how it came out and how I feel about it and so on. But you have to make a decision for yourself. And you recognize when you go down a path, and you go down, that's why the partners chapter is important. It says if you climb too high on any one of the four mountains, you require more and more of your effort, and you basically cannot get to the other mountains. So I'm hoping that people understand that life is a balance. And I truly believe that this work-life thing is, you know, it's hackneyed, it's cliche, but it's so important. But it's also balanced between what I call community and self. I mean, I strongly believe that you have to take time for yourself as well. And but most important, what you just said, I mean, I don't think people today recognize for whatever reason, the importance of a partnership, P1, I mean, finding someone, I would not, you know, you said the same thing that I would say. I wouldn't be here today without Barbara. There's just no two ways about that. She does all the things that I don't do well. She takes care of the grandchildren and the children and the house, and, you know, things are organized, the trains run on time and so forth. It gives me the opportunity to do other things and so forth. And, you know, the golf club, I came back to the house, I was rejected on this bloody island. We're out of here. She said, build a golf course. Changed our life. You know, I was in Greenwich, Connecticut, in a great big house. And she said, we're moving to New York, you know, right after 9/11, which was the perfect time to get out of Greenwich and go to New York. Big decision. Also, with the children and so forth, she really concentrates. I sign all the birthday cards. I don't buy them. Now, she really does that job really well. Of course, one of the problems in life today is that we're going through a transition. We had a very division. I don't know. Yeah, we have a division of labor very early on. I mean, I came home at night, gave her my check, and she did everything, and I went to work in the morning. I was a hunter-gatherer, and she took care of the house and the family. That division of labor has been muddied up a little bit, and that may be one of the difficulties. But I still believe one of the problems is life has been too good. And, you know, it sounds corny, but, you know, we've had a really good period of history, and people don't realize that you will need someone during difficult times. You know, and you know, if you read history, you know, families are much closer in more difficult times. But I mean, I don't want to, not looking forward to having bad times. But I think this has been a unique period of history when things have been really good. And one of the problems with careers is I think that young people are delaying relationships. And boy, I mean, the difference between Barbara and I, at 44, the kids were all out of the house.
Sure.
My daughter is 51 and she has an 9-year-old now, 10-year-old. Mm. You know? So, and it's, you know, it's a lot harder when you're in your 50s and you've got teenagers in the house, you know. So that's society. And, you know, this is a long, hard, you need a bottle of very good red wine and a whole evening to get into this discussion.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very interested about two things. And remind me if I forget one of these. I want to double back and talk about the kind of generational change you've seen where you're the hunter-gatherer, your wife is doing this. Jeannie and I had both relationships. She filled that role for a long time. Also started a little company to supplement what I was doing as a writer. Ran that for a while successfully, so kind of did both. But then, of course, you know, now my daughter is an entrepreneur in New York City doing alternative energy stuff, and she's become the CEO of a small company, and she and her husband both work. She raised her kids in Finland, and then, you know, before her career kind of took off, so she sort of did halfway the other thing. I interview a lot of women on this program who are successful in business or authors and do things. And, you know, the glib thing is, oh, this is all working out. You know, women are going into work and commerce and everything's fine. The fact of the matter is we're transitioning from the model of life that you were in. They're finding it very difficult. This is like
the transition is the hardest part. Yeah.
Yeah. And you must be running into women across the board that you're working with on various.
Well, my daughter is the breadwinner.
Yeah, so talk to me about it.
It's a very difficult, you know, I think she's got it done. He's a house husband and very good and so forth. And I think they've worked it out, but it's not simple. It's not an easy thing to do because there's nothing natural about it. There's no history, you know, of this kind of experience.
And there's no roadmap for this.
There's no roadmap, exactly. And by the way, there are a lot of wrecks along the way.
Yeah.
You know, it's probably starting to correct now, but women who were very aggressive and, you know, and became very successful early on in the last couple of decades, you know, a lot of them didn't have good marriages, you know, and they couldn't.
Yeah, and they paid it. They paid a personal price. And, you know, when you look at
exactly right.
And a lot of them have rejected the kind of thing. You know, you had this book Lean In by the person who was with
Sheryl Sandberg.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden it was women writing articles saying this is BS. We're trying to do this. Good for you, but it's not working for me. And we're not talking about conservative women pushing back on
traditional
family. We're talking about other liberal women who themselves are in the workplace. It isn't that simple, is it?
No, it's not. And, you know, if you're the top of the pile, you can bring your child to work and put them in the corner, like Sheryl Sandberg did in her book. But if you're just a worker being a vice president, you don't do that. You know, that's a difficult. And also, you know, the men haven't adjusted that. They say, we'll do that. Then they start doing it and they don't do a good job of it because there's, again, no training. Most of us, you know, if the house was turned over to us, we know exactly what it would look like in a couple of weeks. So,
yeah.
You know, that's the other. And women, you know, my daughter, she, you know, She looks at the house and she has a certain way that she wants it because her mother is, you know, a Virgo and everything's right. And, you know, my son-in-law is a terrific guy and he tries the best he can, but he doesn't have the same, you know, mentality that a woman might have. So, and that's the transition that's starting to occur. And transition is very difficult. Then you throw on top of that this whole technological change that's going on right now. So that's one of my problems, and that's why I'm pushing. I've just finished a life design course at the University of Rochester, which I'm trying to use my book as a reference and other books as well. But I also think the freshmen ought to get a short course in technology and its effect on society. I mean, I don't care whether you're an English major or a physics major. I think early in the first year, I want to send a message to freshmen in college that we're not only interested in giving you academic capabilities, we're interested in you, and you have to know certain kinds of things. And one of the things we have to cope with is the effect of technology on the system right now. And I want that. I don't know the course yet. It requires a lot of work, but I think that's one of the things that you're seeing right now. And especially if there's a difference in technological capability between a man and a woman. I mean, a woman happens to be in the technological industry, and my son-in-law is an artist. You know, it gets to be very complicated in a hurry because he has to operate in certain technologies, and you know, maybe she does a better job than that. So this is we're going through a major transition. Also, you know, the whole change in society right now, you know, from, you know, the white Protestant American who ran the country for, you know, a couple hundred years, and now we're going into a mixed culture. That's another change. So that's these kinds of changes are not easy to absorb. That's why I want to get back to my very simple language with yourself, so you can navigate this rather complicated experience. But the most important thing, you said it, you need a real partner in this trip, really. And listening to your partner, my wife worked for 25 years as well. She didn't put me, you know, but she worked and was very healthy for our family to have her get up every morning and go to work as well. You know, the kids said when she stopped working, are we going to get rid of the maid?
Yeah.
That didn't go over well.
Hey, I have a question for you biographically. You're Syrian in background, correct?
Yeah, we're not sure. My great-grandfather was a gold merchant or a metals merchant that traveled between Iran and France, probably on camels. And he was murdered around the turn of the century. And great-grandmother, who was a powerful woman, said, we're going to the New World. So we're not, my father spoke Farsi and, you know, and Arabic and Hebrew. So, and he used to change histories just based on who was more popular at the time. But I think we were Syrian. I saw a birth certificate that said basically he was born in Aleppo, Syria. But he could have been one of the trips my grandfather passing through Aleppo when they were born. So I'm not sure.
What about the Jewish part, Jewish Syrian? How's that working?
That was the toughest part of all, because being a Jewish Arab is the worst. You know, and then, you know, you got everybody against you.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah, if you're picking.
and my father, you know, it's a more complicated discussion, but he disappeared when I was 15 completely.
Yeah.
And completely gone. I couldn't find him, whatever else. And I became a ward of the state. And I felt 40, 50 years later that Tom Dewey, the governor of his papers came through. My father was suing the shipping company because, you know, people threatened to kill him because he was a very different kind of person. Being a Jewish Arab aboard a ship and, you know, having different eating habits and everything else, you know, he just didn't fit in and they didn't treat him well and so forth and so on. So, you know, it was a difficult period. But I don't struggle with that. It is what it is. If you go back and try, you can't make restitution. You just got to go forward. And, yeah. But, you know, we were immigrants and he took advantage of everything in America, did really well until 1929 and then lost it all. And never really regained his footing, and it really. And I that's another lesson that I think people learn, that, you know, once you fall hard, just the demons are there. It's just very hard to make it back up, and I've seen that on people in Wall Street as well. And so I've wandered a bit here, but I think that's really some of the answers to the question. By the way, you know, my first book, On the Road Less Traveled, goes into a lot of these things in a little more depth than this book. And that book has sold 15,000 copies, which my publicist tells me that's pretty good for non-celebrity.
I like that. That's great. Just give us the title again.
On the Road, Less Travel.
Yeah, and we will, by the way, Ed, we're going to...
In fact, this is a picture of it here. This is the picture of the car that my father drove me from St. Louis to Los Angeles.
And on Route 66, no less.
Well, there was, you know, the story in the book, I was in Washington, D.C. getting the Henry Shaw Alger Award, and I was really nervous about it because it's the first time my background was being going to be dumped out on the public.
Sure.
We took a walk to the Smithsonian, and I walked in, and a car like this was sitting there, and in back there was a map with St. Louis on one side and a black line to Los Angeles on the other side. Mm. I mean, and then, boy, everything just flashed into my mind, you know. And we drove across country, took like 4 or 5 days in those days. But this book, you know, has been, I mean, I used to be embarrassed by recommending the book, but so many people have said really nice things about it.
And yeah, I love
it. Really and resonated with them.
We will, Ernie, my producer, just let you know, we'll link to all your books so people can get them easily who watch this, as well as anything else that you would like to talk about in terms of linking to some of the work you're doing or the college, whatever you would like people who are getting interested in you because of this to find out about you, just tell Ernie and we'll link to all of it.
Well, just there are a couple of organizations which I've, you know, opened up to me because of the book, a group called Wiley in Boston, which basically has foster kids that they each foster kid they take on must communicate with a counselor at least once a week.
Yeah.
And that basically is the answer in my mind to we have had nobody, all of them now have graduated. This lady, Julie King, went from five students to 75. She's going to go to 200. I'm also involved at Northeastern University in a program with first gens in addition. So I say to people, wherever you are in the country, you know, and you can get mixed up in a school where you can deal with foster kids or first gens or just almost anybody, it's terrifically satisfying because you see these kids who ask the right questions. And if they come up with the right answers, the next step is wonderful. I mean, and more than just a great academic institution, take the local community college. I'm the commencement speaker at the Florida Keys Community College next couple of weeks. And these kids, you know, they want to be nurses or marine engineers or hospitality workers, or even say the woman gave a speech on being a public safety person. She really wanted to be a policeman, and just it brought tears to her eyes. She had two children. She was obviously late getting there, but she was there now. And so that I think that's something I'd like to leave with people. But more importantly, you know, simple message, anything is possible. Education is a solution to almost everything, if not everything. And finally, try never to be a victim if you can help it. And if you feel good about my book, use the 4 P's.
Yeah, exactly. And speaking of which, we will wrap it up. But listen, Ed, the book is The Island of 4 P's. We've been talking about it. We will link to it. Anybody who watches this or listens to it won't have any problem getting it through the links. And, you know, I commend you for the book, but also life well lived and such good advice and wisdom just in this particular discussion we've had. For my friends out there on the left who think that all capitalism is evil, here's the alternative. We have somebody sensitive and interested who's doing good things for people around him. And that's kind of a rebuke to a lot of the folks that aren't. That we've been talking about, but also very hopeful. You know, it's a lovely and uplifting discussion. Thanks for writing the parable here that you've written. This is a good book, The Island of 4 P's, Ed. Hey, Jim, it's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Keep doing what you're doing.
And feel free when this is out, Ernie, our redoubtable producer, will tell you, and if this is any use to you, you can share this discussion because I think it was very revealing of you and very good. I mean, this was a good discussion. Thank you.
No, thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
To save the trade, may the force be with you.
Yeah, thanks, Ed.
Thank you.
In Conversation with Frank Schaefer is a production of the George Bailey Morality and Public Life Fellowship. It is produced by Ernie Gregg and hosted by Frank Schaefer, author of Fall in Love, Have Children, Stay Put, Save the Planet, Be Happy, a post-pandemic blueprint for rebalancing work and family in favor of love and living. To learn more and support the show, please visit lovechildrenplanet.com.